proposal, how does neuromodulation work?
Good morning, everybody. The topic, how does it work, is a topic which can be finished probably in a second. I don't know. And if we all look into the literature, and I was really glad to work with Tanago, and he would even give us the same question, same answer. So to get into this topic, I think one of the articles we have to cite in the very beginning is where we are standing with neuromodulation. And if we go to the fourth point, where is the level of recommendation, it is different for male and female. Opposite to the situation because it's not approved to Botox. But we know that it is working somehow and it is reversible as a treatment option. So to start and to understand, I try to get the saddle on the horse from a different way. I try to think about what are we doing. So we have two situations in the voiding and the storage. The micturition is probably just a few percent of the day and the rest is storage function. So there is a lot of things which are happening in this 97% of the day. And if we go down to the situation, what is happening during this time, the sacral micturition neurons are in the lower urinary tract, and there is interaction between the bladder wall and the pelvic floor afferent to the lumbosacral cord. So the detrusor muscle is innervated with the paraganglion parasympathetic motor neurons in the sacral intermediolateral cell column, ILM. And in addition, we have to see a next organ, more or less, an end organ, the striated external urethral sphincter, which is innervated on the maternal neurus in the nucleus of Ornith in the sacrus cord. So the work of Block has given us a lot of detail information and how this micturition situation is essential to understand. And the stimulation in the pontine micturition center is causing a relaxation of the sphincter and the contraction of the bladder, but this is a special situation. And in addition, if we cause lesions in those areas, then we are running into retention, but it is usually not as easy as in a setting in the CAT. So beside the situation of the normal influence, we have a descending micturition pathway, so the influence of the CNS to the bladder. And Block looked into that with his thesis and published it in different ways, and we saw the beginning, how complex the whole situation is. And not only the descending, it's also important to have an ascending situation. Micturition is a complex situation between the brain and a social situation. So we have to bring different aspects into that. And when we are looking into that, we probably should look first in the healthy men or women to see what is happening, to see the activation, what is influenced, to see what we are later on affecting with neuromodulation, to have a comparison between those. So it is an activation of certain areas in the brain which are calm before. And he showed very nicely that there is not a difference in the gender, which I think is the first point. Also, we see certain pathologies different in the genders. But the pontine micturition center is activated during the micturition, whereas the PSC is activated when micturition is withdrawn. And later on, I would like to show you that even social behavior influences the whole situation. So the whole complex situation is between the spine and the CNS, and we have to keep in mind that they are very complex overall. And when he looked into that, the filling is a new aspect into that. So not only voiding and storage, now we have also a different situation, how full the bladder is, and different areas are activated. And the filling becomes suddenly a point which is in certain pathologies, like in urge incontinence or IC, a different one. So the activation influences the CBF in those participating women or even later on in the pathology. So going back to Michael Krebs, he said when we're going now to the neuromodulation that we are using to influence the physiology to activate neural pathways which are still there in a different way to get a normal situation or close to normal situation. Bloch looked into the situation, what is happening in the spinal cord. And as I showed you before, we can influence the sphincter as a contraction or relaxation from the different areas, if it is the dorsal gray or in the dorsal column, to induce with the stimulation an increase of the sphincter contraction. So all this basic information is more or less what we have seen in the past from Schmidt and Al's publication that neuromodulation seems to work. But in addition, if we look into the normal setting when we try to do a neuromodulation, it is depending on the location of the PNE electrode overall, because with locating the electrode, the effect, the motoric and the sensoric effect is different. And after almost 10 years now, I saw this thesis from Hauck when I was still in Münster. He gave us an idea how the different sacral nerves are subdivided for a different effect. And he made, in addition, as you can see there on the left side, a topographic analysis which nerve root parts are running to the bladder or even to the sphincter. And it gave me, for my clinical work, the idea where to locate ideal-wise the electrodes to have a different effect, which we have to keep in mind, to have, as van der Pol proposed, this setting working. So the possibility sites of action are not only peripheral, but also central, as we can see in the fMRI on the spinal cord, which we are not really seeing nowadays, but on the brain. So there are different aspects. And we are deciding if we are doing it in local anesthesia or in general anesthesia, but usually when we are doing it in local anesthesia, we are looking only for the sensory response and not for the motoric response. So this is a certain difference, but as you can see, the amplitude we are using is totally different, and what the patient is telling us, in addition, which sensations we will have. So depending on the situation, we might more innervate or stimulate the buttock muscle, or we get down to those roots which are stimulating in the very end the pelvic floor organs. And in addition, we made it even more complicated today, or maybe simpler, we haven't decided that, to use the pudendal nerve stimulation to have that. So to reduce the whole situation, I think it is like an ideal situation. We looked into spinal cord patient, complete spinal cord, ASIA A. And why do I think they are more or less an ideal population? They have this accident at a certain time. So we know when the situation started, and we know how long the time is running. We run the video urodynamics. Those who do not agree became controls. And we place in local anesthesia just to do this in a common way. on both sides timed leads with InterStim 2 and followed them up. And what the result was that they were continent, they had good bladder fillings over day, and no reported situation of incontinence. If you looked on their diaries, they even increased that. Also, we told them that they should keep the capacity around 300 to 400. With an additional programming, we were able to get them to satisfying erections and intercourse. If we don't treat the patients, we see the common situation, what happens usually between 3 to 6 months, that the detrusor becomes hyperactive and causes the problem that the patient is leaking. And the control group, as you can see, has the situation of a lower capacity, and they were incontinent. In addition, they had urinary infections. So getting back to this scheme, we were thinking about how could that work to make it probably the simplest, not only knowing that we have the time to determine when it happened. The common situation is that on the end organ level, there is an influence in positive and negative activation and deactivation on a more or less leveled situation. But with the spinal cord lesion, we have an overactivity for the detrusor and the raptor sphincter. With the additional sacral nerve modulation, we are able to influence it. But please keep in mind, at the time when we are placing the sacral nerve modulation, we do not have any close idea what is already happening in the external sphincter. So we were able to avoid the situation of the overactivity in the detrusor, but not for the sphincter. But we are getting closer to be able to influence the system. Going back to basic work, we know that the situation is influenced by the bladder filling, and we can transport this into the clinic, but here in the dog, we were able to see that the dog optimum positioning is around 100 mil, and if we are overfilling it to a certain situation. But in addition, this is both depending on bladder pressure and sphincter, so this is opposite influenced. And we can see these situations, as well as Gupta published, the influence in the brain with the fMRI. So we are activating central situations in a different way. And further, we have to decide if we want to do a unilateral or bilateral stimulation with or without a full bladder. And that is today in the clinic influencing for the overactive bladder, or on the other side, the retention, where we use commonly the bilateral stimulation, which is usually more effective, which has been proven by Kaufmann with a pathology model with a formalin-induced detrusor overactivity to be more active. If we combine all this knowledge, we probably will be able, if the technology is set up correctly, that with a pre-stimulation, we can activate the detrusor individually without an additional sphincter contraction and cause voiding. But still, we do not know where to place our electrodes in the best way to have all this effect at once. Reitz looked into the proposal from Spinelli, where he wanted to approach the pudendal nerve from the anatomical side, and was able to really find the anatomic points to place that. Another predicting factor, which is important, do we only rely to the sensory situation, or do we include the motoric? Is that giving us only information on the peripheral nerve quality, or also on the central situation? When we look it up from the bowel surgeons, they see the situation a little bit different. They cannot determine if there is a prevalence on the nerve. They see almost the same situation between only sensory and motoric response. Also, in the chronic situation, they have only one patient, but he is successful with only motoric response, opposite to the sensory response. But they say that the motoric response is as good as a sensory. From my own clinical experience, I'm getting a little bit back to the situation that I prefer the motoric response. But that might be because we are all focused on the anus itself. But we cannot predict, and that's why we are running in different times, the application of the PNE or the step one to really find out how long we have to look into the situation until we make the decision if it failed or is a success. So overall, there are more questions setting up. Where is it happening? Does it happen in the presacral plexus? And it is definitely more a modulation because we already know that the fMRI demonstrates us an influence and that the current density, we need thresholds which are very low, probably not to cause any side effects, and the frequency seems to be the best between 10 and 25 hertz. And we know that there is a modulatory situation between segments. I think one of the outstanding works for the moment is from Drake, where he tries to bring this up into this graph, and I will later on come back to that because his conclusion is something where I think we can think about for further work. Another aspect I found, and I'm still considering if that is really the correct interpretation, if we look on age, the success seems to decrease over the time as much as if you put them here in groups, younger than 55 and older. So it seems that there is an age relationship. But do we know, keeping in mind the spinal cord injured patient, if we do not have to know when the pathology started? So maybe the influence is independent from the age, but with an overactive bladder, we might not even know how long it already persists. So we know that there is an influence to the CNS, but the real explanation we cannot give. We only can describe the situation as we have seen it, and the effect might kick in after hours or days. With the urge incontinence, which is the most common situation, we know that the peripheral is overactive and depending on the bladder filling. But there is also a difference between urge incontinent women or just urge situation. And if it is switched off, it jumps back to the situation, and we can see the influence of cingulate gyrus and the midline thalamus. And what I think it is important to see that there is a decrease in the activation of those pathologies we have seen before. And the frontal obturic situation, seems to be also having an influence of our social environment situation, like we'll get back to. So during the chronic stimulation, we see a more and longer duration of the effect. The areas on the acute neuromodulation seem to be different, and we all know that from our clinical experience. We usually have a different setting in the testing than we have later on in the situation when the patient receives an implant. So the common situation we place it is for at least a week. I have not investigated it, but we can expect that some of this activation in the acute SNS are disappearing over the time. Block pointed out that there is a learning situation in that as well. And as a clinical experience just a week ago, I placed a bilateral implant and did not activate it yet after a subchronic evaluation, and the patient was the day on the road more or less, and then she came back for programming and she said it's already working. So we have to keep in mind that there is quite a big placebo effect which we cannot really diminish or exclude. De Gupta looked into, I think, one of the best groups which we can determine what the issue is. It's the Fowler syndrome, and looked from the normal volunteers and looked into the activation. I just want to click this through. When you see these different activations from the female volunteers to the Fowler syndrome with the stimulator off and then into the situation with stimulator on, then you see in the next picture that there is a normalization of the fMRI. So in addition, beside the situation, if you click this through, it looks a little bit like, and I know that this is not as easy as it seems to be with clicking slides back and forth, but we see when we look into blocks evaluation that the learning effect might be another subject which is influencing our income, our outcome. So, see, going from blocks work, now a new publication from Ravia has been published, and it shows very similar the situation not only for the activation in the Fowler syndrome, but also the empty bladder and the full. And if you change this back and forth between non-stimulation and with stimulation, you see that there is a lot more going on than we assumed in the past for just one syndrome. So for the long term, we know that it works, even over 5 or more years, and the efficacy is proven. But still, it is very difficult to show what's going on. It seems to be a lot easier for fecal incontinence. And if we look for the ICI recommendation, which I received in addition with further information from Matzel, it is a lot better set up with the sacral nerve modulation, which does have its place today for the bowel surgeon. And they have shown similar outcome as we have, but they looked into further situation after they have included it into their recommendation. And they are able to demonstrate for the organ very nicely that there is an influence not only in the syncteric situation, but also in the situation of the colonic. And now a recent work from the O'Connell group demonstrate also what has been done in from block in the cat, now in the rat, the involvement of the central situation for the spine, and I think they are looking further into that very good. So we know from for the fecal incontinence, similar situation, not yet detailed as it has been performed for the urinary situation, but already on the way for the fMRI situation. And that leaded into this very detailed setting of the ICI that independent more or less from the situation if there is none or even a sphincter defect, that now SNS does have its place in the recommendation and sometimes or commonly is more effective than sphincter repair. So the situation seems to be a little bit easier because more or less they have obstruction and incontinence, whereas it seems that the urinary situation is much more complex and probably needs to be defined in the future. So in conclusion, we have to understand the physiology further and have to find out when there is a starting point of pathology to influence the outcome of sacral neuromodulation. And entities might be having the need to be subcategorized. And the brain shows us a certain plasticity, but we have to understand that. I modified this from the Drake article and just want to point out what probably is important points what we have to consider is the filling, is the brain processes in sensation for urgency and incontinence. We have to do a temporal sequencing. We have to look into the behavior and the social environment situation, pharmacological treatment if they have been included at the time, and the subspinal white matter fibers, and to make a definition and decide what works better for us. And maybe we have a chance, like with the spinal cord patients, to differentiate in a certain situation better from the animal model. So the 5 key points from the Drake article are to understand and refine the understanding from storage and voiding, the CNS response in contribution to the functional syndromes, collateral influence, the mechanism of the when it responds or fails, and identify the key changes in a risk group, which I think is the most difficult we have to do in the future. Thank you very much.
Questions, We talked a bit about idiopathic voiding dysfunction and how that group of patients get the best response from neuromodulation. And everyone was very vague about the urodynamic response and said, well, the urodynamics don't really change very much. So, you know, I was expecting them to say, well, yeah, you know, you get a good detrusor contraction, a good flow. And they said, well, no, not really. The patients just void better. So in terms of the mechanism, are there any clues from post-neuromodulation urodynamics?
From my own experience, I don't more or less do it because I have the same experience. And I take the PNE, and that's what the bowel surgeon do as well, the PNE as a diagnostic tool and not the urodynamic. And that might be the major difference. Probably we all have some patients where we can see a very good response in the urodynamics. But this is where we probably have still a more or less normal lower urinary tract. And it's very difficult to subdivide those patients into those who have a normal urinary tract and those who probably have nerve or central nerve situations which needs to be adjusted to a certain level. I try to explain to my patients always, like with a heart disease, coronary heart disease, until 70% you don't see anything, the patient is feeling good. But if the coronary arteries are blocked over 70%, they start to have problems. But it's very difficult to see the graduation between that. But only when you have a real pathology later on. And it's probably the same with the TURP. When does a patient benefit from the TURP? You have to investigate further, and sometimes they still do not void after you deobstructed them. So it's a very difficult situation, and I think what I try to point out, with a spinal cord patient, we know when it happens, so we can probably, when we understand it, influence the best. With patients, like, as you pointed out, very often we do not know when it happened and we do not know in which stage of pathology we are. And therefore I try to use neuromodulation as a diagnostic tool and do not think about what's happening usually in the urodynamics, because I cannot verify it and I cannot explain it.
Question, you were saying that the sacral neuromodulation can have benefits with spinal cord injury. So it would be plasticity at the higher centers if it were, say, a complete transection. What would be the optimal time that you would want to start this neuromodulation? How would you decide it?
Yeah, well, it was a gut decision. It was out of the knowledge what we are doing with other injuries in the orthopedics, that we try to keep function as good as possible. Momentarily, we decide with a spinal cord patient to wait a year or longer to see what recovers. I think within that year, we are causing a pathology we are not able to reverse. And that's what leads me to the next point, to say probably we have with other diseases already a chronic situation we cannot reverse, or only partially. The time point when we do it is when we verify with the urodynamic that there is no contractility for the detrusor at all. I have done it because patients were really like going after me that they want an implant too. Even it was early phase, but we saw a very small activity in the detrusor and implanted still, and more or less they failed. The other one are really successful. So for the detrusor, that's maybe the key. But it's not the key yet to be able with neuromodulation to influence the sphincter. I'm thinking that we have to go even earlier. But I do not know. I talked to Brigitte. There is a work in Switzerland, but I haven't looked into that yet, that somebody looked into the early changes of the sphincter activity after injury. What I expect is that the sphincter overactivity jumps in even earlier than the detrusor, which would be logic.
Part of the question that I had was already asked by Tony, It's a little bit in the same thing. You nicely show that we expect the mechanism of action to be something sensory, because we see the brain activity that changes, and it appears to be different during acute and during chronic stimulation. And that's also the reason why we accepted that previously that in complete spinal cord injury, there are a few studies that show that it didn't work because the brain was disconnected from the lower parts. But yet in your study, your 10 patients, you show that it may work, or that it works. Does it mean that it at that stage works at a more peripheral level? Does it work differently? And how, I would like to hear your opinion on it. Do you also think that in non-neurogenic ones, it starts at a more peripheral level, and then it goes up and alters centrally? What do you think about it?
It's a very good question, and I had a long discussion with the reviewers to get the paper accepted. But what I think is, probably through the hypogastric nerves, we have still a connection to the brain. I want to prove that on these patients, but you have to convince these patients to go into the fMRI with the risk that they might lose their stimulators. And then I'm in trouble. But the stimulator is far away for brain activity. So that is what we are proposing and what we want to look into. You're absolutely right. So that comes to the next level answer. I don't think it is only peripheral, it's also still central, because we know that patients who have a certain level of injury, when their bladder is really full, develop a high blood pressure. So that demonstrates that there must be still a connection with the CNS. So that gives me the point that we are on the right track. What I think we are doing peripherally is to avoid a pathology we usually waited for in a common sense. But that is then set, and we can reverse it or not. And that leads me to more or less maybe not the easy way to say, maybe we are waiting like for an OAB patient with all the cholinergics too long to be really successful. I don't know.
So you're saying, and I think you're right, that the way we used neuromodulation was to restore function, and the way we might want to use it is to eliminate deterioration.
It is a much better prevention than we think today, because it might stop. Or what I haven't shown here is a situation what I as a urologist did not think about. Bridget would have thought about it right away, but I placed in the common sense for the spinal cord patients the implant into the abdominal wall because I had the interstim. And they still have spasticity, so they pulled out the electrodes. Then I was set up with the interstim too and could place them in the buttock. But the nice thing was, so the patient became a control in itself. And within 2 weeks, more or less, they developed an overactive bladder. And with placing the electrode in the correct position again, we were able to reverse it, but only very short. We have two patients who failed, who did not really work together with us because they didn't understand the setting, and we were not able to reverse them. So that shows us that there is a certain plasticity we can influence in a certain time frame. And that might lead us to the next step for other issues, which we haven't understood today. And that's why I'm having a little bit the difficulties to say older patients do not work. I think we haven't understood, or we cannot really determine when this pathology, whatever it is, started to happen. Thank you. That leads back to the urodynamics, because we do not know how much change has going on in the bladder or in the lower urinary tract, which we're investigating. So we do not know where we are on the time scale. So they might be all different. If we have a patient in the very early time scale, we will see the change with and without neuromodulation, but not with a patient who is over the 70% who might be void, but where we don't see this maximum because we are just able to bring him down 70%. And then we come to the next point. Is an improvement of 50%, as the company says, a good duration point, or does it need to be higher? In our clinic, it is 70%.
I can give you an answer to that. We studied it, and indeed, if you make the level higher and you say we take 90% and you look after 5 years, the responses are much better.
Yeah, well, we have 70%. I just looked into from a different aspect in a smaller group, specific one, step one, infection rate, etc. And we saw that those who complete the implant, 92% were successful. So I think if we are taking that in consideration, it might improve even further. Because if we start, and that's the next question, the plasticity is definitely there. Is there a pathology still ongoing? Patients, and I think most of the people tell me that if you start to change the parameters within that year, they will fail overall. If you have a stable situation where you have the setting from the beginning with a subsensoric threshold so the patient doesn't feel it, and you do not need to change anything within that year, then you're on the right track and these patients will be successful. That's at least my experience, but I cannot prove it correctly.
So congratulations on your excellent research, and thank you, because I've learned a lot from your presentation. I'm just curious, are you prepared to discuss any neuromodulation benefits of the bowel vis-a-vis cross-sensitization or afferent modulation, or have you had any insights with that with your experience?
Well, we have some experience on that, but more as a side effect. And I think everybody as a urologist who is doing neuromodulation sees sometimes patients who start to have a change of their bowel movement. And with the spinal cord patients, we saw that they have a better bowel movement, which is different than those who use anticholinergics or other drugs. So they improved on that and they report that. So what I think, even there, we have an influence on the whole colon. And there, to my knowledge, as far as I know from Australia, has been investigations on that, on the transversum and the descendants, and they showed the influence on that. But I'm a urologist and not a bowel surgeon, so I'm sorry that I cannot give you too much of the detail. Yes. If I don't see you, it's more the light, it's not...
Sure. As a urologist also, I find the functional MRI pictures very hard to comprehend. Could it be feasible that SNS works locally and the brain changes are just the brain's recognizing that something's changing down in the pelvis, so more just a recognition rather than a cause?
Well, if it would be only a local and efferent situation, so it would be neurostimulation again, then we would have a different effect, and that we would expect that it works within short term, like hours. But because we can even determine the latency of the potent, like the Spinelli group is working on with the pudendus nerve stimulation, they are looking on that effect as well and see the effect in the end organ. So I think we are doing two things. We have a direct stimulation and the effect to the brain. And if you look into studies, as one which is coming out from Kiel, but others have done that too, in patients with deep brain stimulation, which is a different level, but there we see very similar effects on MS patients, that they improve their voiding situation or their urodynamic findings, comparable with sacral nerve modulation. And we are stimulating the brain definitely with it, but as I was surprised myself, that learning effects are involved as well, and we have to determine how much social aspects might change our behavior. And we know that this is one of the topics in urology or voiding dysfunctions, and how much we can suppress those with neuromodulation. But I don't have the correct answer for that.
We should get on to the next section.
Thank you very much.
Before lunch is the debate about Botox versus neuromodulation for refractory overactive bladder. And possibly.
This one?
You
can go forward if you want, and the laser.
Okay, thank you for inviting me. We have to make a debate on Botox versus neuromodulation, so I think it will not be a state of the art, but more question and answer. And when we prepare the topic, Paul asked us to speak about what we currently know on Botox and neuromodulation, what is the level of evidence, which recommendation we have, what further research is needed, establish if one technique, which technique should be put in which treatment algorithm, and identify a patient group for different treatment. So I'm not an expert in idiopathic bladder, because I'm mainly working on neurogenic bladder. So I was looking what I was found in the literature, the actual literature, and I found this paper from Anja in the Journal of Urology, which was a systematic review between 2005 and February 2009 on what we know on Botox in overactive bladder. I have to say that at the last ICI meeting, the recommendation for idiopathic bladder was known, the grade C recommendation, and no level of evidence, because the botulinum toxin is actually off-label use. As opposed to Apostolos in the consensus paper, he was more courageous and he put level of evidence 1 and recommendation A. But that's another debate we can discuss after the presentation. So if you look at this paper, it was, I'm sorry for the quality, but at least the authors find 32 articles. The research the keywords were botulinum toxin, overactive bladder, urinary incontinence. And at least from these 32 papers, they have to exclude 359, because it was not overactive bladder, or it was a pediatric patient. From these remaining papers, they reviewed 37 abstracts, and 10 more were excluded because it was using botulinum toxin B or Dysport, or because it was a treatment, mixed treatment. So at least they found only 23 articles on botulinum toxin and idiopathic bladder. And from these 23 articles, they find 3 randomized controlled trials. And I will focus on these 3 randomized controlled trials. Sorry. So, what I was looking at, I have to say that the entry parameters was different in the different study, randomized control study. From the Brubaker study, it was mainly the patient perception improvement score, and the urinary incontinence was a secondary outcome. In the Flynn paper, it was incontinence episode on more than 2 in the voiding diary, in the daily voiding diary, and in the Sci paper it was more than it was mainly urgency with or without incontinence, and it was overactivity. But at least if you look at the pool randomized effect from the 3 study on the number of incontinence episodes, the poor random effect was 3.88, which means that the patient, the number of reduction of daily incontinence was four more than in the placebo groups. Then they looked at the quality of life. The 3 randomized control study was looking at the UDI-6 for Flynn, and sigh and the long form of the UDI for Brubaker study. So what I found that the pool standard effect on the quality of life was 0.62, which means an improvement of 15 points. So regarding the side effects, in none of the study it was a dramatic general systemic side effect. The main systemic side effect was increase of the residual volume, but we have, after I will go more in detail about the doses as these authors have needed. Sorry. So if you see the PVR mean increase in the three study, you see that it was about the odds ratio was about 8.55, which means that the patient with botulinum toxin has a 8-fold higher risk for intermittent for post-voidal residual volume. But this one I will discuss, but because different study, the level, the threshold of the post-voidal residual volume was different from study to study, and the consequence of the post-voidal residual volume was not the same in all the study. So I found this paper from Van Kroeberg. I was hoping that Philip was coming today because we could have discussed this paper, which was published recently in Neurology Internationalis. So they also look at the study for the three randomized control study, and then they was looking at the three biggest observational studies. So, but if you look at the randomized control study, you see that it's a very low group of patients, 18 above 35, year 20, 43 in the Brubaker group. So only big study, the patient with the study with big patient was a study we performed in Zurich on idiopathic bladder. But now look at the doses, and you see that the dose is not only different, but most of the patients are using 200, we use 100. But the number of injection sites is different, and the dilution is different, because in the size studies they use 200 milliliters in 20 mils. In the Flynn, and I want to tell you, Stefan, that is not 8.10, but it was 10.15 injection site, but it doesn't matter. The injection volume was 0.2 milliliter per injection site, in the science study 1 milliliter per injection site, and in the Brubaker study it was 3 mil, which means 3 mil versus 20 mils. It might be a difference in the effect, but it's more a discussion. It's more going to be discussed after. As you can see, most of the study investigators use to treat the detrusor. I am aware of one study. It was a Jack Corco study who injected idiopathic overactivity in the trigon. They didn't find a very good effect. I don't know if they published the study. What they found is that they cannot induce any reflux, but I'm not sure that the results, as I was speaking with Jacques, was very good on the symptoms. I was looking at the duration of clinical improvement and not as a follow-up, but a 6 month in size study is because the study was lasting 6 months. It's a Brubaker study. The duration of improvement, which means the perception of clinical improvement for the patient, was 307 days. But the study from Brubaker has to be stopped because of the unexpected high post-residual volume rate. So at least we have only two study with repeat injection, which is the CASI study, with a duration of clinical improvement of about 13 months. and the Smith study with a duration of clinical improvement of 9 months with a mean rejection of 2 and a mean rejection of 6. It is difficult to say what is the definition of how long does it is a clinical improvement, because if you speak with a physician, you don't know really. You don't know if they expect that the patient are coming back to be reinjected or if they follow the patient regularly. So I'm not sure we know today what is really the duration of the clinic improvement. Interesting is also the cure rate. In the paper, Fukazi, Khan and Schmidt, they tell that about 20 to 30, 40 patients will be cured. But except from the Schmidt study, they do not describe the follow-up, so it might be that the patient has been just not wanted to be reinjected. So that was the study we performed with and we published in 2006. We observed that 85% was dry after the injection, and that this patient was not under anticholinergic. Which is also interesting because in only study, excuse me, I will come back after. So if you are going to the, I'm sorry, I missed one. Yeah, I'm sorry. If you are going at the improvement of the clinical parameter, you see that the reduction of voiding per day is varying between 15 and 40%. But the only study with where the patient were stopping the anticholinergic drugs was the Flynn study and the Schmidt study. Incontinence, so which means this patient, despite of stopping anticholinergic drug, show a 50% at 100% continence, and 85% at 100% continence. At least all of the study show an improvement in the incontinence episode per day, especially in the randomized control study. And as told you before, in the 3 randomized control study, you have an improvement in quality of life. So, now I come to the main side effect, which is the post void residual volume. At least if you look at the 3 randomized control, there was no acute retention. The residual volume was differently defined. In the size study, it was 150. In the Flynn study, it was more than 200. And the Brubaker study, it was more than 200 milli. And you see that in the Brubaker study, 43 patients has to catheterize after the treatment. The problem is the significance of the catheterization, because as they could prove that patients after botulinum toxin who have to catheterize have a still improving quality of life as long as they have no UTI, which means it was more the UTI which was responsible for the loss of quality of life than the need of intermittent catheterization. So that's what we have on phase 1 study. That was the study, the phase 2 study presented by Brubaker in the AUA 2009. It was also a study presented by Chappell at the AUA in 2002. In 2010, the design was same, and it was aiming at comparing in idiopathic overactivity and overactive bladder 50, 100, 150, 200, and 300 units of botulinum toxin. They integrate 313 patients that was idiopathic or symptom with more than 8 urinary incontinence per week. average of 8 or more micturition per day, but the urodynamic criteria of death resolve activity was not required for dentistry. It was a 36 post-treatment follow-up, and the first control was a 12 weeks. They assessed the key assessment was the electrode diary. Urodynamic was on investigator recruitment, quality of life, post-residual volume, and that is, I find, very interesting because it was defined at pathologies more than 200 minutes, but only on investigation recruitment requirement, which means that this BS, this is a BS from the study, UTI and retention. The study has not been published yet. What they observe was the durable efficacy at those of 100 and above, which means 1500 was not enough, 100 was efficiency in the urinary incontinence episode. It was those relationships between the efficacy and the doses, but it was also a dose relationship between the 100, 200, and 300 and the risk of post-void residual volume. So they conclude that the doses of 100 and 150 units provide the appropriate balance risk ratio. And they conclude that minimally invasive treatment that may be offered consider benefit to patients with IORP and incontinence. So the phase 2 study is now finished but not published. So we are still at the point that we cannot give any recommendation grade. So I will jump to the neurogenic. This is more easy for me. That's a study we published in 2005. That was the phase 2 study. I don't want to you know the study, but what we found was the in spinal cord injury patient, if you inject a 300 unit botulinum toxin or the 200 botulinum, you have a significantly decrease in the number of incontinence per day. All along this, at each point after the study was 24 weeks, and we didn't observe any placebo side effect. And it was of the reason of this study that the ICI is to decide to put the botulinum toxin in neurogenic patient as a level of evidence 1 and grade B. But where are we today? The phase 3 study is finished now. The inclusion criteria was the same as the phase 2 study. The study is not published because the results are not analyzed. But if the phase 3 study confirms the phase 2 study, then we will get for reimbursement at the end of this year. So I find also two abstracts on the cost effectiveness from the botulinum toxin. This publication is an abstract that was a 2-year projection for actual cost in the UK in idiopathic detrusor activity using 200 unit botox, but we don't know yet if it is a really adequate doses. And the 2-year projection cost for the projection for actual cost was about £10,000 if the patient has no comorbidity, then £11,000 if the patient has comorbidity, and about £25,000 if the patient had to need 4 times to catheterization. But does the patient need to need 4 times catheterization if the residual volume is not symptomatic, and £27,000 if the patient has a comorbidity and need to be to perform clean intermittent catheterization. And for the neurogenic bladder overactivity, the 10 years projection for actual cost was without comorbidity about £16,000. If you perform in a specialist center, £20,000, and usually you have to edit intermittent catheterization of the in this patient, which may make an amount of £32,000 if the patient has no comorbidity, and £35,000 if the patient have to be treated in a specialist center. The study on overactive bladder from Kelsey was differently. Make a projected quality of life improvement with more than 50% symptom improvement, and he found a potential cost for £6,000 per quality gain. But this is a bias of the study, because the mean time to injection calculated by the Kaplan-Meier curve was 95 months, which is not the case, because in neurogenic detrusor activity usually you have to inject the patient after 9 or 12 months. So I don't want to go to the mechanism of action. We speak yesterday. I think there is so many questions that I am not a basic researcher. I don't want to jump me. So it's not a research proposal, but it's a question which remain to be answered at the moment, because before you can put the botulinum toxin injection, at least in the idiopathic detrusor overactive, idiopathic detrusor activity or a non-neurogenic algorithm. We have to find if we can optimize the injection techniques, the number of injection sites. We have to think, I was speaking yesterday with somebody about where we have to inject. Did we have to inject the detrusor, the subureteral, the trigon, the dome? Did we have to fill the bladder before we inject, or did we have to do it with empty bladder, what I found relatively difficultly, because you have to see where you are. We have to find a benefit-risk assessment. You have to have a predictor of response, especially for my topic in neurogenic bladder, because we don't know why patients are not responding to the treatment. And we have to assess more in detail the duration of the response in both in neurogenic and non-neurogenic detrusor activity. Mechanism of action we discussed yesterday. Are we working on the detrusor, the urotinium, the suburotinium, or both? Are we working on the efferent pathway, or both? Is it a direct or an indirect effect on the afferent pathway? Did we induce a neuroplastic effect? Why 30% of the patient appear to be cured after treatment? We have to have more safety issue, especially diffusion in and out of bladder. I make the study in neurogenic bladder. I found that after injection we find about 28% of the injected fluid outside the bladder. We have to more look in detail at systemic subclinical effect, especially anticholinergic effect, proximal effect on the striatum muscle in the neighboring of the bladder, and we have to look at long-term histological bladder effect. So that was my part. So upstairs.
So Brigitte carefully avoided my favorite issue, the mechanism of action of Botox, but I think I'm going to win this debate, if there is a debate anyway. So to start with, neuromodulation is, in terms of sacral nerve stimulation, is an approved treatment, and Botox is not. And FDA approval for refractory urinary incontinence was 97, then for OAB 99. And actually, there are, it appears that there are more than 35,000 implants worldwide up to 2008, which makes surprising why we have some little data in the literature in terms of numbers of patients. Another issue is the level of evidence. We have randomized trials, and there is no agreement whether it's a level of evidence 1 or level of evidence 2, actually, because the control is immediate versus delayed implant, and we don't really have evidence on a real placebo effect of neuromodulation. The results from this Cochrane review is that are in favor of neuromodulation for leakage episodes, decrease in number of voids, decrease in the degree of urgency in pad usage, increase in volume at first detrusor contraction, increase in bladder capacity, and also improvement in mental and physical scales. However, there is a problem that most of the studies report always on not only on OAB but also on urinary retention patients. A good thing is that most outcomes slowly went back to baseline levels if the implants were turned off, and that could be considered probably as the placebo effect. What about long-term effect? This review from Emmanuel Chartier-Casselet shows that probably there is a decrease of efficacy with time in all in urgency incontinence and frequency urgency. I'm not going to talk about urinary retention. Whereas this one from Philip Vaccaro shows that it's a steady improvement up to 5 years after implantation. This is actually a case series again on 100 patients, and there is improvement of frequency which is sustained, and also improvement in incontinence is also sustained 5 years after implantation. What we need to know basically is what are the cure rates, how many patients that is are dry, and with in OAB wet patients 46% were dry up to 3 years after the implantation. In OAB dry patients 32% had restored frequency up to 2 years after treatment, while 69% had improved urgency. And in another review of case series, that's level of evidence 3, 39% of the patients were dry, 67% had more than 50% improvement. And in the NICE systematic review, which is again level of evidence 1 to 2, 3 or 5 years follow-up of 60% of the patients were either dry or 50% improved. So there is more or less an agreement on the cure rates. They pointed out that 33% of the patients had to be reoperated due to device site or infection related complications, and this is the a major issue, I guess, with neuromodulation. In ICI 2008, the revision rates were reviewed to be up to between 16% and 32%, and similar rates by 5-year follow-up in 17 centers done by Philippa Carrowbrook again. The good thing, though, is that with the new implants and the new IPGs, it seems that their revision rate goes significantly down. And here you can see that it has been reduced to 1/3 of what it used to be before 95. And actually, in this analysis, you can see that it was almost zero revision to implant ratio rate in the last years of the study. So you wouldn't expect somebody from Greece to talk about cost effectiveness, but I'll do that. Is neuromodulation cost effective? It appears to be so. We don't have much evidence, actually, and much data, again, on urological applications. But in this analysis by Bolton and Harrison, the hardware costs only appear to be up to £8,400. And if you add another £5,000 for the battery only in a 5 or 7 year revision rate, that adds up to almost £14,000. They haven't calculated the cost for the two-stage surgical procedure and hospitalization cost, but I don't expect them to be more than £25,000, well, much less actually. So it's probably similar or even less than Botox. And you would there's no mention of complication cost because this was actually an intended treat analysis, so it did include possible complication costs. But we do have studies, as you had earlier from Carl Dietrich, on fecal incontinence, and they have calculated that in the UK it's about £25,000 per quali gained, even less in Spain, actually €16,000 per quali gained. So if we project that to urology, then it probably that tells you that's a cost-effective procedure. But what we need is studies on comparative cost effectiveness, and actually so far it appears that we only have abstract comparing sacral nerve stimulation with Botox. Two of them actually say that SNM is superior to Botox, the other one says that Botox is superior to SNM, so we need more data on that. What about neuromodulation in NDO? We don't have much evidence here. Actually, most of the evidence comes from SARS. We have some publications on SNMs, some on pudendal nerve stimulation, on peripheral tibial nerve stimulation, on IVIS, and on subthalamic cortical stimulation in patients with Parkinson's disease. All report good results, but they're not really controlled studies. The longest report is this one, on SARS, and it seems to have more evidence on SARS, which give good rates in continence, in full erections, in UTI-free periods, and the amount of patients using them, continuously using them, is very good. And in 7 year, in this 7 year study from the Netherlands, shows that 54% of the patients continue to be continent, and 68% had decreased UTI rates, and overall 54% had improved quality of life. So the long-term results are good. I think we initially, when we hadn't had a look at the time, we thought that we were going to discuss some considerations both about Botox and about neuromodulation. I'm going to go quickly through the considerations, and they can generate some discussion if you want. One is about gender issues. The majority of implanted patients are women. It's more than 80%, so that actually explains why we have such a low level of evidence in men, such a low grade of recommendation from the ICI meeting in 2008. Another issue is that 30% of the patients actually fail stage one. And what is the reason for that is a discussion point. And another discussion point is why, if they pass stage one, 30% of them, the implanted patients, fail to gain benefit. And I've put some issues here that may explain or may need to be debated or may need to be further researched. How to reduce the non-responders? Would it be via prolonged test stimulation, bilateral versus unilateral, further improvement in technical issues such as the leads, the batteries, the angle at which the electrode goes in? Should we actually stimulate the S3 or should we stimulate the S4 in some patients? And how many of these things are we missing when the stimulation is done? Also, we need to identify efficacy prognostic factors which have not been identified either in Botox or in neuromodulation. It seems that, again, as in Botox, in neuromodulation, 50% of the patients do not get rid of detrusor overactivity. And I think that raises an issue whether is there a clinical significant detrusor overactivity or not. Also, what can we do to have bladder-specific stimulation to avoid complications such as pain at the leg side or bowel complications? What about other forms of neuromodulation? Do we need to study better pudendal neuromodulation, peripheral neuromodulation, or brain neuromodulation, based on what you heard earlier by Carl Dietrich? Another issue is 50% seem to improve my clinically adequate. And if the placebo effect in OAB studies is as high as 40 to 50%, should we actually aim, as you heard before earlier today, for a higher percent improvement before we advance to stage two? And also, why is there a reduction of efficacy with time? Is it basically a technical issue? Is it because the battery starts wearing off? Or is it the placebo effect that starts wearing off, which we don't know about? And I think we need to look at possible neuroplastic effect of neuromodulation, possible reorganization of neural reflexes, the brain control of the spinal reflexes, and the role of interneurons. There's actually some work here based on Griffiths and de Groot articles that actually point out to the role of spinal cord interneurons, where all those spinal reflexes seem to synapse, and actually Chet de Groot has proposed that that might explain why neuromodulation works both in idiopathic OAB and urinary retention. It's it might be that we have excitatory or inhibitory interneurons which change roles, and these roles have been switched back to normal after neuromodulation. And you heard about the differences between chronic and acute SNS, and which might prove there is a neuroplastic effect. But also, you heard about that in urgency incontinence there is change in activation of limbic regions and other regions which are involved in sensory motor learning. But also in older people, there is cerebral white matter lesions were found to be associated with diminished bladder control and increased activation of the dorsal anterior cingulate gyrus. So, could it be that we have brain-driven OAB, cerebral lesions, a cause of impaired control, while increased cingulate gyrus activation and attempt to cope with imminent loss of control? And if that's the case, should we identify central versus peripheral OAB, and should we have actually brain neuromodulation? So we did come up to some consensus with Brigitte. We need more long-term studies. We need larger patient numbers, we need crossover studies, we need cost-effectiveness studies, we need mechanism of action studies, we need to standardize basically the definition of efficacy. Should it be, should we still keep on going with its 50% improvement rate, or should we actually look at something different, and what do patients want as well? We need to identify prognostic factors of efficacy. I mean, we have been ongoing with neuromodulation for 15 years now, and with Botox for more than 10 years now, and nobody really knows what the prognostic factors are. We need a research on technical issues. You heard about the injection technique that needs to be standardized in Botox, and there's a lot of standardized in SNM, like technical complication, duration of test period, bi versus unilateral approach, and device settings. We have in the new electrodes, there's four electrodes in the time lead, and we can play between anode and cathode, and we can change the device settings, and there's actually no comparative studies done to show what really happens if we change these. And also we need to have a benefit risk ratio assessment. We were going to end up with saying where we stand so far in terms of guidelines and recommendations. I don't know if this one should be after discussion or before discussion. Shall I go ahead? Yeah, shall I go ahead with that then? So it's this is where ICA and EAU guidelines have, I think, the same algorithm for women. So in DO or in mixed continence, if initial therapy fails, then you can have botulinum toxin neuromodulation or bladder augmentation. I don't think the order is has been identified. But what about men? As you heard, the ICI 2008 gave only a greater recommendation D, so there's basically no recommendation. The EAU guidelines were braver, and they pointed out that we could have, if initial therapy fails in urgency incontinence due to DO, then we could have neuromodulation in men. And in terms of NDO, This is a bit, we cannot really understand what this meant, but it seems that neuromodulation, neurostimulation, you can have in either incomplete or complete lesions. I don't know if this goes first and to be followed by botulinum toxin, but our proposals for NDO patients would be that maybe Botox should go before SNM when patients in NDO patients that are already under CIC or with large PVR, as we have less data in SNM and there are a lot of technical issues such as need for repeat MRI as in MS patients. SNM could go before Botox in patients with preserved voiding and stable neurological disease, and also in comorbidities such as fecal erection problems, which seem to benefit also from neuromodulation. And in idiopathic overactive bladder patients, I totally manipulated Brigitte and ended up to say that SNM should go before Botox at the moment, because we don't have enough data on Botox. We have longer term studies in SNS, and there's all these factors that have that at the moment act against Botox, such as unknown benefit risk ratio, little evidence on repeat injections, unknown long-term effects. Despite the benefit risk assessment, it appears that there will always be some danger for CISC after Botox treatment, even with a 100 unit dose. And also, what hasn't been said is that even those patients, 20% of those patients might need to continue on antimuscarinic, which is, I think, not the case with sacral neuromodulation. Thank you.
So we're running a bit late, but we'll just curtail the lunchtime. Alan's had to check out of his room. So.
If you were going to do a randomized trial of idiopathic OAB patients, SNM versus Botox, you've gone through a lot of the benefits and pros and cons, but timing of primary outcome in such a trial is also a difficult issue because of the periodic nature of Botox and the more stable nature of the SNM. So do you have any advice about when you would want a primary outcome time period to be if you had all the money in the world and could do a randomized trial in idiopathic OAB between those two modalities?
I think it will be very difficult to make this study because I don't think that the company wants to compare. But no, I cannot answer. You mean what is the time to follow up?
Well, because the Botox starts to wear off, say it's 6 months or
but we don't know. We don't really know the wear-off effect of botulinum toxin. All the time it is, in neurogenic patient, it is up to the physician. Some physician repeat it systematically after 6 months. In my institution, the patient is coming when he start to have urinary incontinence. I restart anticholinergic, and then I prolong the effect for 12 or 14 months. In OAB patient, you don't know the effects. In the study where they reinject the patient, they do not tell you why they reject the patient. If they reject the patient because the patient is coming and ask for treatment, or are they reinjecting the patient because they objective criteria to reject the patient? So I think it is difficult.
Isn't also the main problem that the protocol for Botox is not known yet?
Yeah.
And we don't have the publication of the Brubaker study. So whilst an RCT is a very attractive concept, you wouldn't know what to put in the Botox arm at this stage for idiopathic overactivity, would you?
I thought Allergan finished their trial and they're recommending 100 units.
Sorry?
I thought that Allergan completed their trial and they're recommending.
They finished the trial. It was the first trial was Brubaker. The second one was a repeated trial, which was presented at the AIU. They emphasize that 100 is probably better, 100 to 250, But at the moment, they didn't publish the study. It's only an abstract. So.
Well, the paper is on the way. Mm-hmm. But, and as you said, the 100 will be the recommendation, 150, because the residual over 200 is later on the cause that catheterization, and then we are running into the issue, do the patient need to catheterize or not? And that even was, as Brigitte already pointed out, depending on the physician. But I think your question is more or less answered with the algorithm proposed, as here on the last slide. It will be so difficult. When do you want to do the crossover? If you start with a Botox, and as Brigitte just pointed out, you do not know how long the duration is on the Botox, then you do not know when to cross over and when you will still have an effect for maybe the PNE or the SNM. So that is the first problem. And if you start, as here for the OAB patient, as you suggested, to start with that and then cross over, then you do not know if there is not like the bias from the first part of the trial. So I think to run a trial with a crossover is something like which is totally impossible.
But and you could run it without a crossover and do it for 2 years, say, and couldn't you?
Then we are getting to the next point, as Anastasia pointed out. The question is, what is more cost effective? Yeah. You cannot do it. To my opinion, at least, and this is what the abstracts demonstrate, when they said that Botox is better compared to SNM, because they only looked into 2 years, mm-hmm. and you have to look into the long-term duration with comparing with the neuromodulation, because it pays off in the long term. Okay. So if you calculate that, that makes it very difficult to get something like that really to the point.
Tony.
I'll be very brief. I'll just ask a question. Regarding neuromodulation, the growth theory is kind of interesting, that it might involve stimulation of intramural parasympathetic ganglia. But, you know, they only constitute a small portion. Most of them are still outside in the pelvic ganglia. But if that's the case, you might just tell me why you think that might work. And if it would work, I guess bladder stimulation might be feasible, right?
Well, it's not really ganglia. It's into neurons somewhere by the spinal cord.
You were saying intramural in the bladder, right?
No, I said interneurons in the spinal cord.
I'm sorry. So then the second question I would ask for regarding the Botox, do you think that its injection is site-specific? In other words, if you inject it, does it not spread? Do you think it just stays very locally?
You mean outside the bladder?
No, when you inject into the muscle wall,
yeah.
Do you think it's staying local at the injection site?
Would it come from the muscle into the submucosa? So even if you inject it into the muscle, would it come into the submucosa? If you inject it into the submucosa, will it go into the muscle anyway?
I think so, but I have no proof, but I think so.
You can see it actually. Well, you can see it when you inject it. You know, it's easy. You can see when you inject it, it spreads. You can see that there's a bleb in the urothelium. So actually, I think you can see that it spreads, even if you inject the muscle, it spreads towards the urothelium mostly.
So you can't really tell. Site-specific would be impossible.
But it's also going into the nerves. We know that already, efferent,
Stephen.
Well, we saw a lot of questions that are still standing for neuromodulation. It may help for your report. There are a couple of manuscripts from our group that are currently under review addressing these things, and some of the main findings were cost-effectiveness. Is SNM becomes cost effective from the fourth year you started. So there was an American study that after 2 years there was a Botox was better. Well, in our model, neuromodulation becomes more cost effective after 4 years. So in the long term it appears to be more cost effectiveness. Regarding unilateral versus bilateral, if you have a failure and you start then bilateral, we had 15 patients, 3 of them responded good. Of the 15, and of them, 2 are still using the device after 2 years. So it's not that good. But that's of course if they failed unilateral stimulation. And then the last thing was the device settings. We tested different frequencies, and for a whole group, we didn't find any difference in outcome if you use another frequency. What you did find was in an individual, you could increase the efficacy and reduce the pain, for example, at another frequency. So you can use it to modulate your effect. But as a group, as a whole, there's no difference.
John, he said it.
As Just to add that the local situation of injections, I think there was a nice MRI study at the EAU showing that it goes everywhere, proven with gradinium at an MRI.
That was my study.
Thank
Sorry?
You. Congratulations.
It was your study.
Yeah.
Good. Congratulations.
It was a very good study, wasn't it?
It was beautiful.
The best. Are there any other questions?
Well, going a little bit into another field, into the end organ, and I think Carl-Eric could maybe add something to that. Nobody can really answer, on the one side, what is a substantial change in the detrusor or in the sphincter from neuromodulation. And on the other side, we do not know, to be a little bit provocative, what does Botox effect in the CNS? Because something is normalized in the muscle for the CNS with a functional situation, so that would be very interesting to know. Maybe that's a way to study if, like in the long term, like after 6 or 3 months after Botox application, fMRI is done, and see what is happening there, and maybe this is comparable to what we have seen in the neuromodulation, but I don't know. It's just a question thrown into the crowd.
As I'm getting older, can I ask the last question? Yeah. You mentioned that age seems to result in less efficacy for neuromodulation. Do the two of you agree? Is it the same with botulinum toxin? And do you agree with neuromodulation? The older the patient, the less good the effect with botulinum toxin.
We inject also older patient, but the numbers as too small. You cannot compare.
Okay.
But it seems to work. But if it is a difference, the number of patients is too small.
But I did not agree with the age. I said I question it.
Oh, you question it.
I question it.
I don't have personal experience, but
okay. Time for lunch. Thank you very much, everyone.